I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to look at the way race, place, design, and history come together to shape urban cores, particularly here in Indianapolis. That will be the subject of an upcoming Taylor Symposium. My guests include Rhonda Henry Anthony and Paul Mullins, both of whom are professors in the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts, and Brad Bobian, long-range planner for the City of Indianapolis. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to have a fascinating conversation today about the ways that race, place, design, and history have intersected, come together to shape urban cores, particularly here in Indianapolis. That's going to be the subject of an upcoming Taylor Symposium. We're going to talk about that symposium, but really about the larger question of how all of these things came together to make the Indianapolis in which we live in and occupy. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Rhonda Henry Anthony and Paul Mullins. They're both professors in the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts and returning for, we were joking before we went on the air, for his third visit, Brad Bobian. He is the long-range planner for the City of Indianapolis. Welcome to Rhonda and Paul. Welcome back to Brad. It's good to have you all here.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to throw this first, I think, to Rhonda and Paul. Talk to me a little bit about this symposium and, you know, what all is involved.
Well, the Joseph Taylor Symposium, this will be the 29th year for the symposium, and it commemorates the first dean of the School of Liberal Arts. His name was Joseph Taylor. Dr. Taylor got his doctorate from IU in 1952, went to Flanner House in 1957, and spent the remainder of his career at Flanner House and at IUPUI, working in the Near West Side. And he had a sustained commitment to community engagement, to extending academic knowledge beyond the walls of the academy. Today we take that as a somewhat, we take that as a as being typical of most universities, but it was a very unusual political move during Dr. Taylor's, when he was here. So each year a different department manages the Taylor Symposium, and this year it happens to be anthropology, but we share so many interests with departments like Africana Studies, in which Dr. Henry Anthony is in, that we work with many of these colleagues in the symposium.
Okay. So what should we expect from this particular symposium, Rhonda?
Well, I should probably let Paul take that, as the Department of Anthropology is the one who's organized this, but certainly I've seen a preview of this when we did the, I think it was the Vance Symposium. So it will be a combination of scholarly sort of research and findings and data from that perspective, but also including the community and community elders who will be speaking about their experiences in Indianapolis during this time that Paul and Dr. Sue Hyatt's work is sort of studying. But again, I'll throw it to Paul because he knows the details.
Okay, Paul, talk with me about this particular symposium.
Susan Hyatt and I did a project, the Charles Bance Community Fellowship, last year, and we spent a year studying invisible Indianapolis. So these hidden histories of life along and across the color line. We're particularly interested in issues like redlining, construction of the interstate, displacement by the university itself. So we wanted to do a public symposium that spoke to those issues. We have some academic voices. For instance, Richard Pierce, who wrote a really fabulous book called Polite Protest, will give a lunchtime lecture. We will also have a colleague of mine, Christopher Zuski, from Wayne State University in Detroit. She does very similar kind of work just in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And we'll also have the voices of community elders. And Dr. Henry Anthony is going to interview some of these elders. So we'll have community folks, and we'll also have some of our professional colleagues who do kind of nuts and bolts and neighborhood histories for folks that are interested in architectural histories or cemetery histories or doing their genealogy and using digital resources.
Details include, I'm assuming it's open to the public if
yes,
people choose
is.
To attend. When is it, and is there a cost associated with it? And if so, where would people buy their tickets or make their reservations?
It's at the IUPUI Campus Center on Thursday. It's free to attend the symposium. If you'd like to eat lunch during the day, you will have to pay for that. But we'd be happy to have you for the lecture, lunchtime lecture, free of charge.
Okay, so basically the only cost then is the food that you do. So what are some of the subjects that you anticipate talking about and attempting to engage the public on here? Let's start with Paul, but I also would like to hear Rhonda's thoughts on that.
Well,
and I promise, Brad, we are going to pull you into this at some point.
I'm ready.
Yes, okay.
Well, I think actually one of the issues that Brad can speak to actually quite well, we're very interested in redlining. How did the city get laid out racially? How was it segregated over better than 100 years? And how can we see the legacy of that segregation even today on the contemporary landscape? Some of those transformations happened a century ago. Some of them, like the construction of the interstate, happened actually quite recently in the last half century. And many of them still have very dynamic ongoing effects even today.
Mm-hmm. Rhonda, what do you expect to?
Well, I think that the Taylor Symposium will be another great opportunity for us to speak to some of the issues that will remain invisible, as the project is named, otherwise. So, in fact, my family was born and raised here. My grandparents came in the 30s or 40s, and my grandfather and my grandmother experienced many of the sort of consequences of redlining in different neighborhoods, as well as the declarations of eminent domain and blighted areas that were used to sort of take homes and land from minorities to give to the highway or to give to IUPUI. And so I think that, again, the Taylor Symposium is a great chance for the community to learn about this invisible history. And if it weren't for Paul and Sue's work, that history would be unavailable to us because many of these elders are now gone. I mean, my grandfather almost lived to be 100, but he died in 2013. And so these stories are not told for the most part and need to be told. And I'm really just thankful to have colleagues like Dr. Paul Mullins and Dr. Sue Hyatt who find this work important and who bring these voices to the fore so that for posterity we can hear from them.
Brad, before we go too much further, we probably ought to talk to people about what redlining is, what the practice is, and what the term means.
Yeah, so redlining was a practice in the 1920s, 1930s, from the financial industry. And so it really started back in the Great Depression. And so President Roosevelt was attempting, you know, to get the economy moving. And so he had the New Deal program. In 1933, Congress established the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And the purpose of that organization was to create the secondary mortgage market. And so before this time, when you bought a house, you borrowed money from the bank, and that bank was out the money until you paid them back. So to free up capital and get the economy moving again, Congress created this Homeowners Loan Corporation. And so they borrowed money from private investors with the purpose of kind of buying up troubled mortgages. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
But because they were on the hook for buying up these mortgages to get the bank's capital free to loan again, they were on the hook to private investors. And so they wanted to make sure that they were buying investments that they could sell. And so one of the things that they did was they went around to every major city in America and they graded neighborhoods from A to D. And the neighborhoods that were in D were colored red on the map. And so that's where we get the term redlining. Now, what that meant was neighborhoods that were graded C or D, so towards the bottom, basically they could not participate in the financial institutions. You could not get a mortgage. So the government would not participate in the secondary mortgage market and buy that from you. And so those neighborhoods that were condemned to the C or D gradings, basically could not get mortgages. They were condemned to cash markets or a lot of rental. And so many of those neighborhoods, if you look at why they were graded C or D, race was the one of the predominant factors. And so you had cards for every neighborhood. I'm looking at one right now for Crown Hill neighborhood. And one of the detrimental values is infiltration of people of color. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the neighborhoods that were so designated? For those of us who have an understanding of Indianapolis and can put it together with the geography.
Well, what's really scary is if you look at the map of race today, it pretty much lines up one for one. Mm-hmm. And so you look at neighborhoods like Maple and Fall Creek, Martindale, Brightwood, places like that, even the Near East Side. You had neighborhoods where you had a concentration of faces of color, and those were deemed unsafe to make investments in. And we still live in that with that legacy nearly a century later.
We are talking about it's a complicated subject. We're talking about ways that race and the growth and design of the city and history have intersected to shape the world and the city that we live in here in Indianapolis. That's going to be the subject of an upcoming Taylor Symposium on Thursday. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So what are the themes, then, that we're going to explore in this kind of community conversation? Is it more about how all of this happened, or a larger exploration of what it meant, what it did to the people who lived here? I'll start with Paul first, largely because he just looked at me. But otherwise, I'd like to hear everyone's thoughts on that.
Well, I think my response would be that actually I think for many people this history is completely unknown. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we simply want to do for my students, my neighbors, my colleagues is simply raise consciousness that this is a process that
this world we're in didn't happen by accident.
Yeah, this has reached over 100 years, and there are still processes that are very similar and have a very active effect on the contemporary landscape. So this is not a dead history. Mm-hmm. However, we cannot have an effective conversation about public policy in the contemporary world if we don't really have an understanding of the heritage that's led up to this contemporary condition, I think.
Well, and I guess where I was going with that, though, is, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, this happened, but I think the four of us here understand the implications of those decisions that are, you know, a century or more older. Are we going to talk about what the implications were, what the, you know, the human considerations that came from what were at some level public policy or economic policy decisions? Rhonda?
Well, I'm sure hoping that we are, and I think that both Dr. Hyatt and Dr. Mullins have set up a sort of forum where we can get into those issues, especially through talking with folks like the elders who lived in these areas at these times, who can speak from their own personal experience about these things that are just sort of theories or government statistics to us. And so I believe that we will be able to get into the issues in terms of human toll and how these kinds of policies around the city and around the nation have kept us in the same situation in the city almost 100 years later.
And who are some of the elders who are going to be addressing that? Do we know?
One of the people we're going to have is one of my neighbors, Paula Brooks, is past president of the Ransom Place Neighborhood Association. We have some folks from the Near South Side as well. So we tried to get some West Side folks as well, some Near South Side folks, somewhat different experiences on the ground. But we thought those would be good starting points for this conversation.
And what part of this, Brad, I mean, you're the one who actually has to make those kinds of decisions now, or at least provide the counsel so that other people can make the ultimate decision, the elected officials. What sort of insights do you hope to gather from this?
Well, I think, you know, And you mentioned that there's a reason why all this happens, and Paul said it's important to understand that. And for me, when I see patterns throughout our city, when we have patterns of poverty, patterns of racial segregation, patterns of inequities, patterns of health, public health crises, and they're all stacked on top of each other, you have to start asking each other why. Mm. And certainly public policy, from our 1926 zoning ordinance that actually enforced segregation to the redlining that we talked about, and then real estate practices thereafter, there's lots of reasons why. And in order to start undoing some of those reasons, we need to understand where they're coming from.
We're going to continue the conversation in a moment. We're talking really about invisible cities, the invisible parts of Indianapolis. My guests are Rhonda Henry Anthony and Paul Mullins, both of the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts, and Brad Bobian, long-range planner for the city of Indianapolis. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about, you know, a complicated issue, complicated history, that's going to be the subject of an upcoming Taylor Symposium at IUPUI this Thursday. It's about the ways that race and place and some of the political, economic decisions, design decisions, affected urban cores, particularly here in Indianapolis. I think the term we have been using is the invisible city, the ways that the city took shape that we don't see or have remained hidden. My guests are Rhonda Henry Anthony and Paul Mullins. They're both professors in the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts, and Brad Bobian, who is long-range planner for the city of Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Robin has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I was listening to your program.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention that Fountain Square was a large part of my life. I am biracial. My mother is white. My father's black. And we moved to Fountain Square in 1962. We lived not far from the actual Fountain Square on Spain Avenue. It was mostly Appalachian at that time, Catholic and Irish, poor, working poor. And we did face a lot of racism at that time.
Well, thank you for sharing your memory. I'm going to get some responses to that. Thank you very much for the call, Robin.
Okay, I just want to say one more thing, if it's
sure.
possible. I remember my mother bought her house in 1962 in Fountain Square for $8,000, and she sold it in 1980 for $8,000, and now that house sold recently for $250,000 because of the gentrification of Fountain Square.
Yes. Thanks very much. Okay, so, Rhonda, I saw you nodding your head up and down in affirmation here. I'm going to give you the first crack at this.
Well, what I would say in response to Robin's comment is just that she's outside the areas that blacks are supposed to be in. And certainly being of mixed race, that gives her a little more racial ambiguity in terms of maybe the way she appears. But she's still, if she's still black phenotypically mm-hmm. in terms of looks, then she's going to experience what it means to be black in Indianapolis and in the U.S. in a larger sense. And so when you're outside of those areas designated for blacks at that time, then you're going to experience a little more racism in terms of where you actually live.
Well, and I think this is what Paul was making reference to in the last, that there are policies similar to this. You know, a lot of people typically think of neighborhood renovation or reclamation as a very positive development. But we made reference to the, I guess Robin made reference to gentrification, that the fact that often it ends up chasing people out of neighborhoods that they have historically inhabited. And the worst thing is it would be one thing for, say, Robin's mother to have chosen to leave that that neighborhood having collected $250,000 on her original $8,000 investment. But that's often not the way it works, that the profit comes to other folks. Is that a valid assessment of what's going on and what the implications are now?
Well, certainly it is. The historically African American Near West Side, there's very little historic architecture left anymore. My campus takes much of it. The university, as well as state government complexes, lots of apartments have been built there. Ironically, many of these new developments, which are pricey apartments and condominiums, many of these places play on their location in a quote-unquote historical neighborhood. So in many ways, they ironically leverage that history to create a very much a gentrified neighborhood. That certainly is happening in Fountain Square as well, and it has certainly priced out a lot of folks that once lived in these neighborhoods.
What sort of challenges does that create for someone in your position, Brad?
So there's a couple challenges, and obviously the story of gentrification, well known. Obviously, people being priced out of their homes, being dislocated, things like that. But I kind of want to pick up on Robin's, when her mother sold her home for the same price that she purchased it for. And obviously, in America, the home is the greatest wealth building opportunity asset that we have. One of my biggest concerns, we do have places in town that are gentrifying. Obviously, that is a concern. That's something that we share. We, in those types of places, we have funding. We try to preserve affordable housing, invest in affordable housing. We need to be doing a better job in investing in people and growing people at the same time the place is growing. But there's a larger part of our community where we're actually sort of having the reverse of gentrification happening. We have places that are losing people and losing values. Mm-hmm. And those places also happen to largely coincide with race when you overlay the race map. And so we have places where we have some African-American homeowner neighborhoods, and they're continuing to lose value. And so, we have a population that's did everything they're supposed to do. They've lived the American dream. They bought the house. But the systemic challenges that they face continue to follow them, and they're not reaping the benefits of that equity. And so that's just kind of the opposite of gentrification is happening too. And so from my perspective, we've got both challenges, that public policy that we have to figure out how to address. Both of them are wicked problems with no easy answers.
We're talking today on No Limits about the ways that that race and really public policy, economic policy decisions have intersected to shape the city of Indianapolis. That's going to be the subject of an upcoming Taylor Symposium at IUPUI this coming Thursday. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So I want to picking up sort of on what Brad was saying there. We've got this history, this legacy that is out there. And, it seems clear that it is a legacy of significant injustice, which leaves us then with the question, what can be done about it now? What should be done about it now, to the degree that we can help Brad do his job? I'll start with Paul on that one, but I want to hear Rhonda's thoughts, and then we'll let Brad actually talk about the ways that this informs how he does his job. Paul?
Well, I'm not a policymaker, but I believe the very first step has to be an open public conversation and discussion. We have to understand this heritage. We have to understand these conditions. And we have to understand them with a fair amount of rigor and systematicity. Something more than I saw it on the news or I've driven through that neighborhood once or twice and we have a kind of impressionistic sense of what any given neighborhood is like. We need real rigorous scholarship, and we need to talk to people that live in these neighborhoods and understand their ethnographic experience living in these places, the things that attract them to these places, but also the challenges structurally that they face in holding these communities together. What kind of policy that will lead to in any given part of the city or any given city may be actually quite different depending on the place, But it will never happen if we do not have the sobriety and honesty to first have these discussions in the first place.
I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate with you there, because I'm thinking if, you know, you're in one of these neighborhoods that's actually losing value, and that people, and these are not people who had a whole lot to begin with. I would think in their position, hearing a message that says, oh, yeah, we're going to try to figure out something to help you after we've done several years of study, is not going to be a reassuring message to them, that they'd want to know at some level, is there anything that can be done to help us now? Rhonda? And then I'll give Paul a chance to respond. It's only fair.
Well, I could understand how they would feel because, again, my grandparents lived in these areas. They lived in the Brightwood area, Martindale area, around that space. And, you know, these are the spaces, are part of the spaces where we're actually losing home values. And my mother still owns homes down in there from my grandparents. But what I think we also have to realize is that, as Paul said, this is systemic. I mean, they were disadvantaged when they first came into those neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. They were disadvantaged while they lived there. And then they were disadvantaged when they sold their homes in those neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so there's a trajectory here of continuous disadvantage mm-hmm. that has to be acknowledged and has to be faced by the city of Indianapolis and other cities around the country who have, you know, put concerted effort into keeping a population down. And I mean, we can drive through these areas and think, you know, well, why do these people still live here? Why do they do this? Why don't they try to improve their neighborhoods? But as we can see, there has been a constituted effort to keep people living in situations where they can't find decent housing, or there is a food desert, or nobody really wants to invest in those areas. And so, again, until the city really decides that there are not areas of the city that we're just going to throw away, you know, until we're ready to come back to them and gentrify them, we're going to be in the same position. So I don't think, again, as Paul said, that there are any easy answers. And I think that people really want someone who is going to be genuine in terms of coming up with answers in conjunction and in collaboration with them, that will not sort of come in and superimpose outside sort of solutions that don't really fit the situation.
Mm-hmm. Paul, I'll give you a chance.
Well, one of the things I would say is, well, of course, we could have a 10-year-long study. However, there are very consequential and modest interventions that have real impacts that we could make. Simply pairing a good public policy person with an ethnographic scholar, walking around a neighborhood with an elder, having a discussion with them a few hours, that could change policy for that planner in really radical sorts of ways. And this is not super labor-intensive. There are some ethnographic skills to learn, but many planners have a good start on that already. And sometimes they just need to be introduced to elders in a community. They need an entree and they need to explain to a community, you know, exactly what is the planning that we do and what are the sorts of things that we can offer to these particular neighborhoods.
Brad, you're obviously aware of these pressures and these trends. How do they inform your knowledge? How does your knowledge of them inform how you go about doing your job?
So as a professional planner, I have an ethical obligation to voices that are typically underrepresented in planning processes. That's something that the American Institute of Certified Planners is part of our code of ethics. Now, a lot of planning and a lot of politics in general is who you hear from. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a concrete example. Real-life story happened here in Indianapolis. 56th and Keystone, there's a new Meyer, right? When that was going in, there were lots of neighborhood residents opposed to that. Typical concerns about traffic and things like that, property values, things like that. At the end of the meeting, a gentleman came up to me, and I never had it be this blunt, but he said, "Brad, do you know what this is about? They're building the store for 46219, which is a low-income black Martindale Brightwood neighborhood. What happens when those people are walking down my streets?" And I knew that NIMBYism opposition to affordable housing, opposition to apartments.
Probably ought to explain here. It means not in my backyard.
Not in my backyard. But, you know, opposition to some of those things. Yeah. I mean, people are not always coming from a bad place of heart. People coming from, you know, they're preserving their way of life, their neighborhoods, their property values, you know, where they're raising their families. But But social constructs of race and class enter into those conversations. And so in that case, that particular person was not opposed to the Meyer really about traffic or about property values. It really wasn't about that. It was his perception that because there was a grocery store nearby, that people would be able to take the bus up and come to his neighborhood, and that was causing concern for him. And so at that meeting, I didn't hear from residents of 46219, is kind of my point.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I design planning processes, when I go out into neighborhoods and have conversations with people, I listen to the people that are there, obviously, but I also pay attention to the voices that are not there, and I attempt to make extra efforts to try to find that voice or at least represent that voice. And so planning is oftentimes about who you hear from.
Well, and there's another theme here, because it's one we've done several shows on things where I'm trying to think how I want to frame this question in as neutral a way as possible, where people will have a concern about something that is likely to alter the place in which they live, a new development. Most recently, it was a new mosque in Carmel. And the argument is not, oh, I don't want those people, whoever they are, coming into my neighborhood or my sphere or anything like that. It's, I'm afraid my property values are going to be affected. Is that a code increasingly? Rhonda's nodding her head, so I'm going to go with her again on that one.
I'm going to nod my head at a lot of stuff here, let me just say. But it is code for, you know, I don't want those undesirables or those people who usually code for people of color or low-income people in my area. I'm afraid that, you know, there's going to be theft or there's going to be burglaries or there's going to be. And I mean, we all have these fears. I mean, let's be honest. However, when you keep a whole set of people down based on your fears about property values or your fears about your own personal sort of space, I mean, where is the line? Other people need opportunities as well.
So, Paul, I mean, the persistent theme I have heard from your, you know, what you've been talking about here is that you want to make these invisible parts of the city and its history visible. There are some parts of this history you want to drag out into the sunlight so that we can look at it. How do we go about doing that?
I actually don't think it's that complicated. We simply have to be honest. Sometimes I think as Hoosiers, you know, we're very civil people, and we have a little trouble wrestling with difficult subjects out in the open sometimes. But this is a subject that we need to wrestle with out in the open. There is no other way around it. We have to break those codes down, and that may be uncomfortable for some people. I mean, we have to really ask what's beneath the resistance to using parking as a smokescreen or my property values. These are just, this is just window dressing for deeper anxieties that probably do have quite a bit to do with color line racism. You know, we just need to understand how these people see the world and how we can make them comfortable with change and how we can help them to understand the privileges they have and share those structurally.
Yeah, I guess, and again, this is in part me playing devil's advocate. That's a conversation we've needed to have in this country for 300 years.
Certainly.
What makes now different? I'll stay with you on that.
It's true that historically this conversation has failed us since Reconstruction, at least. However, that is no reason to let it continue to fail us. Now is always the time to have a difficult discussion. You can, if you want to make structural changes and you want to work through these issues, we just have to have the courage to do this as a community.
We are talking about invisible Indianapolis, basically, the parts of this city and the ways it was shaped that we don't see. That's going to be the subject of an upcoming Taylor Symposium at IUPUI this Thursday. My guests include Rhonda Henry Anthony and Paul Mullins, both of whom are professors in the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts, and Brad Bobian, who is long-range planner for the city of Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about really the invisible parts of Indianapolis's history, the ways that race and design, public policy, and other forces shape the city in ways that were disadvantageous to some groups and advantageous to others. It's going to be the subject of an upcoming Taylor Symposium on the IUPUI campus this Thursday. My guests are Rhonda Henry Anthony and Paul Mullins. They're both professors at the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts, and Brad Bobian, who's long-range planner for Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Ethan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. And it looks like we just lost Ethan. His cell must have dropped the call or something. So in terms of this discussion that we are talking about, and I only gave Paul a few seconds here. I don't think anyone is disputing that, well, anyone reasonable is disputing that we shouldn't try to have the conversation. Other people have tried in the past. What are things we have learned from those attempts that maybe help us force a different kind of conversation, one that provides a little more resolution this time? Rhonda, I'll start with you.
I would say that part of what has been the issue is that people who don't have power or who don't have the privilege of living in the nicer neighborhoods or who are not white, frankly, have not been at the table. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, politically, where the policies are actually determined and as, you know, public planners, all of that, we're not really seeing people of color represented in those spaces. And so what I would say is that there needs to be more people of color at the table to have these discussions within these sort of spaces where these decisions get made.
You were saying during the break, in reference to Brad's comments, that it's better that at some level this stuff is out in the open. So I'm going to ask, you know, we have seen an uptick, obviously, in racially charged disputes in this country, racially charged language and all of that. Is that a good thing? In that ultimately, because I know it's painful for a lot of people to have to deal with it, but at least we can no longer pretend that we don't have a race challenge in this country. You're nodding your head, and silence doesn't work so well on radio, so I'm actually going to ask you to speak.
Okay. Well, I was trying to politely wait until
you were
finished.
I know.
But I would say that the bad side is that these things are being said, that people are being hurt. But the good side of this is that this underbelly of racism, sexism, homophobia, all kinds of things that we have going on that are usually under the surface and that we use code words in regards to, is coming out. And so while, you know, people who look like me are probably not the happiest right now, and I would even say that we're in a nadir sort of moment in the American political scene as well as socially and culturally. This is a time when I feel like more young people are being sort of activated to move into spaces of so that their voices can be heard, and that more people of color and more disadvantaged people are also moving out into public spaces so that they can be heard. And so that we've been kind of in a place of comfort because these things are not being said, but that makes us in a space also where these things are not being addressed either. So I think that it is good in that sense, but it's not good in the sense that we're seeing all this conflict and sort of all this racial sort of stuff going on right now. But we can use that to our advantage.
We are talking about really invisible Indianapolis here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Brittany has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Brittany, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call. I happen to live in, and this is an important discussion, so I'm really pleased, of course, that you're having it like many of your discussions you have there on air. I happen to be one of the many people who do live in what I would agree is kind of an invisible area where we do have a food desert. I do feel like we're kind of underrepresented. Recently, since the new mayor came into office, we actually got an extra street light, which to so many people might seem like such a small thing, but to us, it means that we feel like such an enhanced sense of security, and we feel as if we're being seen metaphorically and literally, and just those small differences make such they have such a huge impact on us. And I think that so many people who live where I live might feel as if we don't have representation, don't have access to City Hall, so to speak, don't, you know, really understand that we have a way into the system to be able to participate and have representation, because we're all just kind of so busy trying to just like exist in that space that we're all in, you know? So I just want to thank you for the conversation and also to ask, like, what would you suggest to people who live in a space like mine, how to get them to participate, how to allow them access into that kind of participation? I don't think my answer off there. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Brittany. So, and I've got a follow-up based on what Brittany said for Brad, but I'll start with Paul on her larger question. How do you get people involved in this conversation?
Well, my sense was, you know, what she was saying is she has a set of concrete experiences in the community. They have problems that they want to address. They simply structurally don't know how to actually articulate that in public policy. You know, that is one of the things that we're always interested in anthropologically is how can we bridge between policymakers, the city council building, and folks living in these neighborhoods? How can we make their voices, help them to make their voices heard in ways that they feel are more effective? Because I think one of the things that she articulated that I hear quite a bit is people just get frustrated. And they realize going to city council meetings, it's a lot of work. You got to talk to a lot of policymakers. And you strike out quite a lot. And it wears people down.
So, Brad, the place where I wanted to pick up on this, too, is part of what I heard from Brittany, too, and I agree with everything Paul said, but about what she was saying, was also sometimes here, you know, these satisfactions can be improved. You know, when we talk about urban planning or something, we think of things on a massive scale, putting, mass transit, for example, and that, you know, is a multi-billion-dollar investment and is likely to disrupt all sorts of things. And what she's really saying, I heard her saying also, is sometimes just putting a light in the right place can make a huge difference.
Yeah, it's interesting that came up. We just completed a visioning process for the city called Plan 2020, and out of that, I was expecting big things to come out. Indianapolis does big things very well. Mm-hmm. We build football stadiums without a team. You know, we do big things very well. Where we have struggled is the day-to-day life. And so you brought up mass transit, public transit. You know, we have, you know, an $800 million football palace. Mm-hmm. And within sight of that, you have bus stops and ditches. Mm-hmm. So it's that daily life that we struggle with. You know, we turn away volunteers when we host the Super Bowl, but we struggle to get volunteers to read to our kids. And so it's that nitty-gritty of daily life that really makes us, or could make us, a much more humane, much more equitable city. And so that is where we struggle. And so whether it's a street light, whether it's a curb ramp so your mom in a wheelchair, you know, can all of a sudden get to the grocery store, it's little tiny things like that that matter to people. It makes what I do relevant to their lives. And so a lot of how people can get engaged, going kind of back to the original mm-hmm. question, people do get beat down when we have public meetings during the day. Well, mm-hmm. they can't get off work to get to a public meeting during the day, or we have public meetings where the bus doesn't go. There's things like that that we need to do a better job organizing our system around. The city does have staff called Mayor's Neighborhood Advocates, mm-hmm. MNAs, and those are the staffers inside of city government that you can contact, and their job is to help.
We're talking about the ways really race has shaped this city, and our history with it continues to affect life in this city to this day. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Dorothy has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Hi, Dorothy. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. And I mean, it's a great show, and I just wanted to clarify one thing that I think was interpreted wrong from a previous caller. The woman from Fountain Square, my understanding was that her mother only made $8,000 off of that house that she sold in Fountain Square, which is what she spent on it. And that was back, I think, in 82 or 84 or something.
She sold it in 1980.
The caller commented that recently someone else made over $200,000 on it. And I thought I heard you say that you thought the mother had made the $200,000, but she did not, from my understanding.
No.
She only made $8,000.
No,
so I
actually.
Yeah.
No, actually, she bought it for $8,000 in 1962. She sold it in 1980 for $8,000. So technically, she made no money on it whatsoever.
Correct.
And if you're accounting for inflation and all of that, she lost money on her investment over time.
Right.
That house now is worth $250,000, so somebody else presumably has made that money. Thanks very much.
That was my point. I was thinking that you said that it's unusual because she made that much money.
No.
But maybe I misunderstood.
No,
I'm sorry.
Most likely it was that I was not clear. So thank you very much for the call and requesting the clarification.
Thank you.
Certainly. Walt, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
Certainly.
Taking my call. I'm born and raised in Lockville Gardens, and when I came back from the service, I lived in an apartment on the south side, and then when I was able to buy a house, I bought it on the Near East Side, Emerson 32nd Street, and as I was purchasing a house, I noticed the house was the neighborhood was transitioning from white to black, and after 3 years, it was totally black. And then I bought another house, which was a much larger house on the near north side at 79th and near 79th and Michigan Road. And again, I had a realtor direct me to a house that was more or less directed to the neighborhood was mixed. And I'm thinking that the realty companies are complicit in this endeavor of segregation housing.
Thanks very much.
That's my point.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a good point, and I know Brad wants to jump all over it. So thank you very much for the call, Walt.
You're welcome.
Certainly.
And so those types of real estate practices are now illegal. The Fair Housing Act of 1968 made that completely illegal. And so if that has happened recently, that is grounds for a fair housing complaint. Now, that has happened. And so after kind of the public enforced segregation, so after our racial zoning ordinance was declared unconstitutional, after private covenants on land prohibiting sales between races was deemed unconstitutional, a lot of those practices invaded the real estate community. And so you would have what was called blockbusting. Mm-hmm. And so a real estate agent would go up and down a street and instill fear in the white homeowners that a black homeowner was moving in. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it was great business development for that real estate agent because all of a sudden, every house on that block went up for sale. At a discounted price. And so that was, racially motivated fear that was driving those real estate decisions. And so That's all completely illegal now. And so if that is happening, that should certainly be reported to fair housing authorities.
What is? Do you know what the penalties are for that kind of conduct, though?
I do not know that.
Because in theory, by profession, I'm trained to be skeptical and to express this. You know, technically, driving above the speed limit is against the law. If we asked for honest expressions about how fast all of us drove to get here, for example, today, I would bet we wouldn't get a strict adherence to the speed limit. Technically, we violated the law.
And it does require complaints. It's a complaint-driven system. There is a Fair Housing Center that does kind of cold calls. And tries to catch apartment owners and leasing agents and things like that in the act. And when that stuff happens, there are civil lawsuits that can be filed to enforce that. And I would presume, I don't know this for a fact, that the professional real estate agencies would have a significant problem with one of their agents engaging in that practice.
So I'm going to throw this back to Rhonda and Paul, since we're getting close on time here, and say obviously a large part of the symposium is going to create an occasion to have some of these difficult conversations we've talked about. What do you hope the outcome of those conversations will be? I'll start with Paul.
I think what we aspire to do is to have a conversation that doesn't last just one afternoon, that is always ongoing. And we want this to just be one expression. This is one space in which we have this discussion. Some of it is done in our classes that are conducted in neighborhoods in the city. Some of it is done in peer-reviewed literature. Some of it is done in conversations with policymakers. And some of it is done in with our community constituencies as our partners drive in research and our common interests. So I think we simply want to make this one piece of a conversation that does not end.
Rhonda.
And I would say that I too hope it will spark a larger conversation, but not only about housing, because another issue that comes with this, especially when we think about gentrification and people's abilities to do anything to their home to fix it up or to maintain it, is employment. And within Black communities, there are much higher unemployment rates. There's not the potential for building any kind of wealth or savings or that kind of thing. You know, we had studies that came out last year or the year before that talked about this. And so, again, I hope that this will spark a larger discussion that will get into more than just the issue of housing, but also other issues of inequity in the city.
And real quick, the symposium starts when and ends when on Thursday?
8 o'clock in the morning until 2 in the afternoon.
Until 2 o'clock, and it is free to the public.
On the IUPUI Campus Center.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for what has been a lively and provocative conversation. I'd like to thank my guests, Rhonda Henry Anthony and Paul Mullins, both of whom are with the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts, and veteran guest Brad Bobian, who is long-range planner for the city of Indianapolis. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for some great questions and for their attention during this conversation. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.